Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Do not put your 401k in crypto.
But
do
how
not
about
put
walking?
Your 401k in crypto. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rosendahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make the day make sense. In addition to some other comments, it is Friday today, the 22nd day of September.
It is indeed. And welcome, everyone. I am Kimberly Adams. We are so happy that you are joining us here on our YouTube live stream, which we like to call Economics on Tap. And that's what we do every Friday. It's our happy hour episode because Lord knows we need it every week. Yeah, that's what I got.
We absolutely do. So we're going to do what we usually do on a Friday. Those of you at home can repeat along with me. We're going to do some news. We're going to take a little break. We'll do a round of half full, half empty. But first, we will get into what people are drinking. Kimberly Adams, what is in your glass today?
It is an Earth, Wind, and Fire old-fashioned. Because yes. When Ellen asked me what the drink was this week, it was Thursday, which, as we all know, is Earth, Wind, and Fire Day. And so I looked for an Earth, Wind, and Fire-themed cocktail, and I found a recipe for an Earth, Wind, and Fire old-fashioned, which had an ingredient that I had to get overnighted to me, sorghum syrup.
Wow.
Who knew?
Sorghum syrup? So first of all, yes. Who knew you could get sorghum syrup overnighted? But what is sorghum syrup? Is that anything like molasses or?
It's similar to molasses, but not. But it is also sweet and like dark in color. And I'm trying to look at the recipe from Cocktail Contessa is where I found it. And what is sorghum? While many people have heard of sorghum and have enjoyed it on biscuits in the South, not everyone knows it's a tall grass of African origin that grows well in climates cooler than those found in the Caribbean. The tall canes can be pressed and juice, and the juice is cooked down into a sweet, thick, viscous, earthy syrup.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry,
sorghum.
Hold it up. Hold it up and let me see it. So what does it look like, your drink? Oh, all right.
No
okay.
Fashion.
And how does it taste?
I haven't tried it yet.
All right. Well, here we go.
Oh, it's good. I was worried it was going to be too sweet, but it's not. It actually works. It does kind of lend the earthiness to it. This was an interesting recipe because it called for me to smoke the glass before I put the drink in to be the fire component, which thankfully I had my little smoker. I did. I smoked the glass first. And yeah. And I don't know what the wind part is. There, wind. Okay. What's everybody else drinking?
So Ellen is probably really annoyed with me because I got that email yesterday. I got the Slack and I just didn't know. And then I forgot about the Slack and I didn't tell her. Also, I feel really boring because my answer is always beer and yours is, I'm going to have a, you know, Guadalupe citrus, you know, whatever umpty frats freaking thing. Anyway, Big Yikes from Modern Times Brewery down in San Diego, double IPA.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't have to do anything this afternoon. So that's what I'm having. That's what I'm having.
Yeah, I should mention, I made mine non-alcoholic with my non-alcoholic whiskey because I have to be up extra early tomorrow. So I'm being,
what are you
I'm
doing?
Being good.
What are you doing?
I'm going on C-SPAN.
Really?
Yes, yes. I'm going on C-SPAN to fill in on a Washington Journal.
Okay. Insert
why not?
Nerd joke here. Okay.
Come on. Who wouldn't want to be on C-SPAN in the lead up to a government shutdown? Come on, man.
On a Saturday morning at the crack of dawn. Oh, my goodness. It does not get any better than that. Look, whatever.
I am who I am, and I love my nerdiness. Mm. Yeah. Okay.
Washington Journal. Yeah. Sorry. Anyway, there's a lot of Washington Journal love.
Have you ever seen it, Kai? Do you know what it is?
Yes, I've seen it, because you have to flip through that to get to the other channels where there's actual good content on. No, I'm sorry. I'm kidding.
Ouch.
Come on, Kimberly, come on. But also, Noel King, our mutual former colleague and your friend, sent out a tweet of a couple of weeks ago of you interviewing her about Vox Today Explained. Mm-hmm. I saw that too.
See, that was good content.
That's true. Okay, Jin Peck says this, and then we will move on. We're all watching an economic podcast on a Friday night. Nerds assemble. So
this is true. Very true. All right. Well, then I'm going to go first with my news, because my news is very Washington, very not so insidery, but it just tells you that corruption knows no party. Obviously, many people have heard that today Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, and his wife were indicted on charges of bribery. And I just want to read from the Hill here. Federal prosecutors announced the charges Friday and said in a search of the senator's home, they found $100,000 in gold bars and $480,000 in hidden cash. According to the indictment, Menendez and his wife agreed to accept hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes in exchange to protect three New Jersey businessmen, and as well as people in the government of Egypt. And it's just a mess, but wow. I mean, and much of the $480,000 in cash was, quote, much of it stuffed into envelopes and hidden in clothing closets and a safe. Envelopes of cash inside jackets in home. Oh my gosh, it just goes on and on. How awful.
Also, the cash was hidden inside his Congressional Hispanic Caucus jacket. Like inside his Senate jacket. Come on, Senator, give me a break. Also, apparently he Googled the phrase, how much is 1 kilo of gold worth? Which, by the way, is about $67,000 at today's price. Come on, man!
So the Senate Historical Office says Menendez appears to be the first sitting senator in history to have been indicted on two unrelated criminal allegations. So we now, at the moment, have our first former president who's been indicted and our first sitting senator to be indicted. What a time to be alive. And then that brings me to my next one, which is yet another amazing scoop by ProPublica about the Supreme Court, where Clarence Thomas apparently participated in Koch Network donor events. So not just like hanging out, but actually going to the fundraisers. Wow. Now, of course, the Koch group says that he was not involved in any of the fundraising activities, but he was at these private retreats at least twice. And as I was thinking about these two stories today, it really kind of made me think about the important divisions we have in the democracy as it's supposed to function, the role of the press. Incredibly important in revealing this stuff about Clarence Thomas and other Supreme Court issues. The role of the Department of Justice in actually going after people who have committed crimes, regardless of political affiliation, or allegedly committed crimes, regardless of affiliation, and hopefully landing where on the side of justice. And, you know, one would love to believe that someone would see the Menendez indictment and say, look, and also the Hunter Biden stuff as well, and say, look, they go after everybody. If anybody breaks the law, they go after them. But no, that's not what's going to happen. But I'm hopeful that maybe this will make at least some people see that it's not always a witch hunt.
Look, so this is a moment, excuse me, this is a moment for the Democratic caucus in Congress and Democratic leadership everywhere to really set themselves apart from the GOP. Because by and large, Republicans in leadership and Republicans in Congress and Republicans at a national level have not condemned. Look, everybody's entitled to the presumption of innocence and Donald Trump and all his 91 indictments. He is innocent until proven guilty. Right. Statement of fact. But the Republican caucus writ large has only attached themselves to him more closely. This is an opportunity for Democrats to draw a real distinction. And I would submit that if they don't, Republicans are going to hang it around their necks and drag them way, way down come next spring and summer.
I'm looking at this other article in The Hill. Here are the Democrats who have called for Menendez to resign. Governor Phil Murphy, the Democrat from New Jersey. New Jersey Democratic Party Chair Leroy Jones. Representative Andy Kim, also a Democrat from New Jersey. Representative Mickey Schrill. I mean, the list goes on. House candidates, former members, everybody.
Right. Here's the two names. Actually, there are three, but one can't. Biden cannot and should not and probably won't. So that's good. Schumer as the Senate Majority Leader and also Cory Booker, the junior senator from the state of New Jersey. Cory Booker, who, full disclosure, is a college acquaintance of my wife's. Cory Booker in 2017, stood by Menendez, and it will be very interesting to see what he does this time.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We watching for it. I mean, it reminds me of when we had the conversation of what would it, like, who in the Republican Party needed to speak out against Trump for it to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the people that you listed was actually Mike Pence, who has since done it, and it's made no difference. But anyway.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. It's a very good point. Yeah. It's a very good point. Yep.
Okay, I know I'm going on forever and ever, but I have to give you this one because
it's our podcast. We get to do whatever we want. Don't worry about the time.
But this one is purely for you, because as I was researching deep into government shutdown stuff today, I came across this article from Washington Monthly from 2013, when there was yet another government shutdown. And the headline is, "Time to brush up on the Food and Forage Act of 1861, everybody."
History matters.
All right, let me find this. So basically, when they're talking about when there's a government shutdown, federal agencies are not allowed to spend money that has not yet been appropriated by Congress. Right. Some people are forced to work without being paid, but you can't spend money. You can't buy new things, except with specific exemptions, and the example given is the Food and Forage Act of 1861, near the start of the Civil War. As the title suggests, that law permitted soldiers to graze their horses and take whatever necessities were required to live on horseback. It was a law that was invoked in a decidedly non-horsey sense during the Vietnam War, again during Operation Desert Shield in Iraq in 1990, and for a brief time immediately following the terror attacks of September 11, 2001. Under this act, basically what it allows is for federal employees to accept volunteers or go beyond their funding in cases of emergency involving the safety of human life or the protection of human property. It's what allows the military and, you know, to keep buying food for the armed services, you know, to feed our military, feed and clothe our military, even when there's a government shutdown. So that's at least the legal interpretation. So anyway.
History's amazing.
Yeah. History's amazing.
That's why you study it.
The Food and Forage Act of 1861. You're welcome.
And I appreciate that you thought of me. I truly do. Okay, so here's
podcast.
Mine. I suppose I have to associate myself with those.
History, economics, politics, we do it all.
Washington Journal on a Saturday morning at sunrise. Anywho. So here's mine. We talked about this, I don't know if it was this week or last week, the idea that President Biden is in something of a bind with the United Auto Workers strike in that he wants to be seen and declares himself to be the most pro-union president this country has ever seen. But also, he needs the big car company CEOs to come along with him in our transition to electric vehicles. And he is working really hard to make that happen with the Inflation Reduction Act and all of those things. Well, so the president has decided, and he has come down on the side of the United Auto Workers Union. The White House announced today that the president will go to Detroit on Tuesday, and more specifically, will walk the picket line with them. That is huge.
It is huge. It's going to be the first time, isn't it?
Huge. It will be the first time ever. It will get ginormous amounts of press. The president will brush up his street cred with the United Auto Workers Union. But I think it comes either a day after or day before, Donald Trump goes to Detroit and does not walk the picket lines because the United Auto Workers Union president, Sean Fain, has said, we want nothing to do with Donald Trump. But Trump will go to Detroit and have a rally with pro-Trump union members and will sell it as him being pro-union in a very smart political move, right? So it's very interesting that the two leading candidates for their party's nominations, well, I guess Biden is the only candidate for his party's nomination, will dive into the UAW strike, which just expanded today. They will dive into it early next week. Now, I have to give a shout out, despite all their broiness, to the guys on Pod Save America, specifically Dan Pfeiffer, who he and Jon Favreau have a really good analysis of the kind of campaign that Donald Trump is running. He is running a much smarter, much more effective campaign this time than he did last time when it was all, you know, or 2016. When it was all, you know, bailing wire and spit holding it together with him and Corey Lewandowski and like four different people on his plane. Now, Trump is going to Detroit, the heartland of number one, America, but number two, organized labor in this country, and passing himself off as a pro-labor Republican president. And for some part of this electorate, that's going to work. And it's going to be really a challenge for the Democrats. Go ahead. Sorry.
Isn't that just what Kellyanne Conway told him to do in 2016?
Yeah.
Because
it's
her strategy was brilliant. She said, we do not care about winning the popular vote. We care about winning the presidency. And she exactly narrowed in on that demographic. Because I remember at the time, I did a story. I went to Granite City, Illinois, to a steel mill there and talked to the union workers there. And they were had been straight blue pro-union Democrat folks, and they were all voting for Trump. And that was one of the two things that made me really think that Trump had a chance to win. It was that, and when I heard him say, and I think it was the second debate, that he promised to elect pro-life judges to the Supreme Court. And I was like, okay, so now he's got all the evangelical Christians who turn out to vote like bonkers. And now even the unions are saying, the union workers are saying, because they're like, yeah, even though our officials are saying we're going to go for Clinton, we're not. We're going to vote for Trump. And I was like, yeah, this guy's got a real chance now.
Right. Right. And also the thing from Kristen Welker's Meet the Press interview, where he was triangulating between the 6-week ban on abortion and the 15-week ban on abortion and putting that in the mix. And betting that he is now going to be able to attract some fraction of voters who are kind of okay with that while knowing that the pro-life voters who want a nationwide ban or something less than even a 6-week ban are still going to vote for him no matter what he says.
Yeah, there was an interesting article about how the pro-life groups are trying to figure out what to do because Trump gave them what they wanted, and now they've got it. Yep. But now he's backing up, backing down, and they don't want to bash him because Trump keeps a grudge. And if he does win, and when he probably will become the nominee, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to be stuck with him. Very quickly, back on UAW, though, did you see the report in Axios this morning about the leaked messages from the union leaders?
I did. Go ahead and tell people what that is. I have thoughts.
Okay, so the headline is UAW official says union creating chaos for automakers leaked messages. And basically, somehow, some way, a bunch of messages, private messages from the platform formerly known as Twitter, X, got leaked. And it's a ton of internal communications about strategy from UAW communications director and a bunch of other folks. And it is pretty bad. It looks really bad for them in terms
bad
of
for the
revealing.
Union, yeah. Yeah.
Bad for the union in terms of revealing what their strategy is. It's giving the automakers some arguments that they're not actually bargaining in good faith, which is something important to the NLRB and labor negotiations. Mm-hmm. And it also makes them look a little condescending of some of their membership. And so anyway, we can link it to it in the show notes. I haven't seen it too many other places. I wonder if that's like their scoop. But let me tell you, I'm awfully sus that under this new Twitter / X regime, that the union leadership's private messages somehow, some way made it to the public. Conspiracy theory, maybe, but I am sus.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I don't think it's a conspiracy theory at all. I will say, I think, number one, it was naive of union leadership and union communications officials to put that stuff on Twitter.
Yeah,
that was
a platform
idiotic,
they don't control.
Right?
Yeah.
Totally idiotic, right? But number two, I am amazed, truly, at how successfully strategic the union has been so far. The small amount of strikes that they started with at those three plants, something like 12,000 workers, which is less than 10% of total membership. And then today, bam, right? 38 plants in 20 states shutting down distribution centers, not for all three of them, right? But just for GM and Stellantis, and setting Ford apart, and thus putting the three automakers in some sense, which has never been done before, against each other, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Sean Fain is a militant son of a gun and way in your face, but they are being so smart about this.
And Ellen points out in our Slack that this news about the leaked messages was first in the Detroit News. It's behind a paywall. But anyway, they were the ones who had it first. So shout out to them for getting that.
Shout out to them.
Yeah.
Shout out to them for sure.
Okay.
Okay. Well, shall we?
Yeah. So, yeah. So that is it for the news. And I know we've gone on a long time, but we are able to do that because of you all. Because it is that time of year where we do need to turn to you all again for support because, you know, it's that time of year. And I was supposed to bring my hoodie, but I forgot. It's downstairs. But it's half-priced hoodie weekend this weekend. So it is a rare chance to get a Make Me Smart or Marketplace hoodie when you donate $8 a month, or I think that's $90 annually. Don't do math. Nope. $90. $8 a month or so. Anyway, at midnight on Sunday, they go back to $16 a month. So that's why it's half-priced hoodie weekend. Yes. And the last time we did this was what, like a year ago or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really comfy. I wear mine all the time.
It is. I am told very cozy. I do not have mine in my possession anymore because I think either my wife or my daughter has stolen it. But look, this is a win-win-win. Support public service journalism. Stay cozy. Get a special deal this weekend only. Give right now. Marketplace.org/givesmart. And thank you very much. And right now is where you say we're coming right back. Oh, that's me. Oh, wait.
Yeah, that's
we're coming
your
right
line.
Back. I suck. All right. Half full, half empty is the game. If I can read my rundown the right way, Drew Jostad is in charge. Please, Drew, save us from ourselves.
All right. This is the first year the IRS has lowered the threshold for taxing ticket resellers. Are you full or half empty?
I saw that.
So this was in the journal. Yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Basically, it's a warning that if you were out there reselling your Beyonce tickets or your Taylor Swift tickets, and if you resold those suckers for more than $600, that's reportable income, and you better watch out. And it, I guess it's sort of in line with the whole Venmo Cash App thing, where if you sort of do more than $600 in sales, I guess, if it's labeled sales, a year, you're supposed to report that income to the IRS and pay taxes on it. So I am going to be half full on people, everybody paying taxes, although I wish it was more equitable. And it's, you know, I hope the enforcement is balanced on the tax dodgers up and down the income scale.
Yeah, same. Same. What Kimberly said. Totally. Yeah.
Okay. Are you half full or half empty on Spanglish advertising?
Oh, so this is a story that Elizabeth Trouble did for us the other day, keyed to a report out of Pew, but also just the changing demographics in this country and how, you know, advertisers are dealing with it. I think, number one, however people choose to and are able to communicate is important. And look, advertisers are going to follow. So I'm half. I'm going to say half.
I don't know. I feel really hesitant to weigh in on this one because it's like, I don't know. Half for the people who want it. Also, just like half full for the people who want it, half empty for the people who don't. I just feel, I don't know, I'm not so plugged in, and it's not my community, and so I always worry about being like, this is great, this is not, because it's like, I don't know, man, it depends. So opt out, abstain, possibly, pass.
Abstain. No, I think abstention is a fine response. I have no problem with that, as opposed to our former boss, Nancy Cassett, who the heck knows where she is right now, but she gave me a hard time once for abstaining. And I, you know what, it's our podcast, we can do what we want.
Whatever we want. What's next?
That's right.
All right. Are you half full or half empty on the orange egg yolks?
It's a wild story.
This was an interview that I did today on the radio program about the rise of those really orangey egg yolks that organic companies and companies like the Happy Egg Company sell for, hang on, $10 a dozen, which, you know, marginally might taste a little better, but look really good in the Instagramization of American food. I did promise in this interview that I did today with Marion Bull of Eater, I promised that I would go to the farmer's market this weekend and buy some of those eggs and taste them. I don't know. It's a little bit foodie preciousness, but at the same time, you know, food matters? I don't know.
The thing I will remember from that story probably forever in all of my days is that in order to get those bright orange egg yolks, they feed the chicken marigolds and turmeric.
Yeah. It's a little bit cheating, right? It's a little bit cheating. Yeah. Yeah. No, totally.
I will be half full on making food look more appealing and food that is in some ways healthy, you know, for in moderation, of course, making it more appealing and interesting. And like your guest said, you know, if it makes people want to cook more, then great. I don't like eggs. I dislike eggs actively.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah,
that's so
like
funny.
I can't even handle like French toast. It's I cannot deal.
Really?
I have
that's
no
like,
skin
that's
in this
like
game.
Egg adjacent. That's not actual eggs.
No, can't do it. I can taste the egginess.
You and Nancy Fargali. Fargali and I had a whole conversation today before the show. After she listened to that interview,
so
she's like, "Yeah, I don't do eggs. I can't do eggs. They're gross." And I'm like,
oh,
"All right,
gosh,
okay,
yeah.
Sorry." There you go. There you go. All right, what's next?
Ready with the poll?
Yes,
oh,
we will be ready with the poll.
Thank God Drew is paying attention. Yes, polls. So if you have a thought and if you're on the live stream, get ready to weigh in on a live poll. We will figure out how to give you the results in about a minute or so. Although, you know, we've been doing this poll for a year and I still haven't figured it out. So Drew's going to give us the thing. Kimberly and I will kill some time. And then we will give you our thoughts. Drew.
Yes.
Are you half full or half empty on a relaxed Senate dress code?
I have such thoughts. I have such thoughts.
Go for it.
No, I can't go for it yet.
Okay.
I have to wait.
I can.
We have to kill time.
I suspect I know where you're going to land on this. But so somebody in the chat is asking me, would you, could you on an omnibus? I'm sure there will be
many. What does that
even
mean, would you, could you on an omnibus?
I'm guessing it's a half full, half empty equivalent.
Oh.
But I don't know. Like, the Senate has been sort of sitting on its hands, working on their own stuff, and they were trying to let the House do what the House is supposed to do and originate the appropriations bills. But I think
not just supposed to do, by the Constitution is required to do.
Yes, but they're also required to not
store
gold bars in their house.
Was I yelling? Sorry.
Yes.
I guess I was yelling. So
they have some stuff ready to go, I think, that could be picked up by the House. And I wonder how much pressure the Senate is going to put on McCarthy to basically be like, take this, take the Democratic votes and get this done. But the second he takes those Democratic votes,
yeah, he's done.
They're gonna come after him. It's really hard for me to see. Like you said, in what did Sudeep say in the show today? That there's a very narrow path to a soft landing.
No, it was Sudeep actually. Sudeep Reddy in the rap today. He was like, there is a very narrow path to a soft landing. Applying it to the Republicans in the House, which I thought was genius.
Yeah. And I, you know, and to just further add to the nerdiness, I was out with, you know, at a birthday party last night, and there were political scientists and journalists there, and this was what we were talking about, and it's a hard belief. People are pretty much thinking there's going to be a shutdown, at least a short one.
Oh, 100%. 100%. You don't actually think there's not going to be a shutdown?
I am leaning one direction enough that I spent a good chunk of today developing a shutdown plan document for kind of stories we can do.
That's
where I land. I spent many hours on this today. That's where I land. Okay, so on this particular question, let's go ahead and close the poll on the question of the relaxed Senate dress code. I am half empty. I actually think that there should be a dress code in this setting, but I don't necessarily know that it needs to be the dress code that they had. I'm sure there still is a dress code of some sort, but I just think that there needs to be, I like the idea of there being some formality. And especially in the Senate, where it's supposed to be sort of the more reserved and astute and thoughtful branch of Congress. And I don't know. I like the vibe.
I completely agree. In fact, I would go farther. I am absolutely opposed to the relaxation of the dress code. And I need to be clear here, right? So first of all, this is geared towards Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, who we've spoken about before on this podcast. I think this week we talked about the whole body double shenanigans and all that jazz, and Senator Fetterman's challenges, all of which I have great admiration for him for having fought through and overcome. That said, I believe decorum matters. I believe formality in certain circumstances matters. I believe it lends itself to a more, people are going to call me naive for this, a more elevated discussion, a more restrained and polite, which I understand is a funny word to use in the American political context right now, a more polite discussion. So that's number one. Number two, I think it's a mistake to gear a policy toward one member out of 100. That's just not good policy. Number three, I think this was just the stupidest possible shooting yourself in the foot by Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, right? Well, and here's why I say that. Schumer has now set himself up for being torpedoed by Republicans in the Senate talking about the dress code and civility and why it matters, and we are not going to have discussions about what people are wearing. Susan Collins came out the other day and said, well, I'm going to wear a bikini on the floor of the Senate the other day. And nobody needs to have those discussions. But more to the point, Joe Manchin, a member of the Democratic caucus, is going to introduce a measure next week, a bipartisan measure, he says, to reinstate or reaffirm the formal dress code in the Senate. And I don't for the life of me understand what Chuck Schumer thought was going to happen. Did he think this was going to be fine and everything was going to be great? I don't get it.
And also, just like, don't we have better things to do?
Well,
like,
I mean,
I don't know,
oh my God,
fund
yes.
the federal
oh my
government.
God, yes. Oh my God, yes.
Fund.
Yes, just, 1,000% yes.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know.
It's just dumb. It's just not smart. Just not
so
smart. Where's the poll? I don't actually have the poll.
Like zoomed by. I saw it and I just didn't say anything. Okay, so half full. 62% are half full on the relaxed Senate dress code.
Really?
37% half empty. 166 votes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Crystal Hurt in the chat makes a good point. A single exception is reasonable accommodations as required by the Americans with Disabilities Act.
And Senator Fetterman has gotten all of those reasonable accommodations for the stroke that he had, right? He has been able to use speech-to-text translators to deal with his challenges that he's had translating questions into his answers, right? He has also, by the way, as we talked about the other day, made remarkable progress, as you can see in interviews he's done, with that challenge. I totally agree. And Senator Fetterman should get every accommodation he needs to deal with those challenges. I don't think that goes to being able to put on a suit and tie.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Senator Duckworth, you know, and many other people who have
explain why Senator Duckworth needs those accommodations.
Yes, Senator Duckworth is a veteran and lost her legs. I believe it was a helicopter crash.
Yep, she was a helicopter pilot.
And she was a helicopter pilot and uses a wheelchair and has accommodations and shows up to the Senate in a suit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also was the first senator in a very, very, very long time, we talked about this, to have a baby while in the Senate, right?
So, I mean, all four reasonable accommodations, but reasonable accommodations do not then need to be applied to the entire Senate. It's a reasonable accommodation for that person.
Yep.
And in this case, I don't know. I think we've spent too much time talking about this.
There we go. Let's go.
Yes.
I think that was a totally good discussion. I have no problem with hanging around on that one. No problem. And I think Senator Duckworth is a really good example. So, question, comment, thoughts on what Kimberly and I ought to wear on this podcast on a Friday? I don't even know. Leave us a voicemail, 508-UBSMART. Email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. It will get to us and it will be read. I promise.
Yes. And don't forget, we do have a newsletter, too. If you had been interested in my Earth, Wind, and Fire old-fashioned recipe, it was linked in the newsletter this week. That's where we share our reading recommendations from the team. We have the beer and the cocktail suggestions. And yes, we see you, Jasper. You've made your appearance. You can sign up at marketplace.org/newsletters. He just came to stare at you.
That's all right. It's all good. Wow, we went long today. This might be the longest Friday ever. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Berg. Secret Today's episode was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our intern is Niloufar Shabandi. Drew Johnstadt wrote the theme music for our game, Half Full, Half Empty.
The team behind Half Full, Half Empty is Emily McCune and Antoinette Brock. Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. And Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on demand. I wonder how they decide that she's the executive director of digital digital and on demand. Or are they just messing with us?
I think they're just totally.
They're just messing with us.
Well, there we go.
That was something.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.